continue on. Bishop Niemi go on to some hemopoietic malignancies and continue tomorrow. So sickle cell anemia. Basically, it's irreversible sickling. And becomes very hard, obviously, to once it sickles, to get it through the red blood, through the capillaries. So you're going to have basically a what would be a problem with somebody with sickle cell disease is exercise. If you exercise, you sweat. So you're losing volume. So what would happen to the viscosity of your blood now? And what would happen to now the ability of the red blood cells to get through the capillaries be more difficult? So what would build up would be you go from aerobic to anaerobic. You make now more lactic acid or have lactic acid accumulate. Now you get sickle cell crisis as a consequence. So obviously, how would you treat it then? Patient coming with a sickle cell crisis, what would you treat them with? And they're in crisis. Just think logically. If exercise got them into problem, what would you give them? Rehydrate them. Thank you very much. You want to increase their blood volume. You rehydrate them. They're complaining of shortness of breath. What would you give them? Oxygen. Very good. Because what type of anemia, what do you get always? What type of cell injury? Well, it's that easy. Now, when you take the exam a week from this Wednesday, there'll be hypoxia all over the exam. You just have to recognize it. That's what we've been talking about all quarter long. This is to help to bring it all together. So the decreased pH or the acidity of the blood will cause the hemoglobin S to form the polymer. And one of the things that helps patients is a drug called hydroxyurea. Hydroxyurea is given and it causes the bone marrow, and the mechanism is not well understood, to make more fetal hemoglobin. And the fetal hemoglobin relative to the alpha chain is such that it will not sickle, and so they tend to be much better off. So when you have a sickle cell patient and they're having this hemolysis, you get erythroid hyperplasia because you have inability to basically take care of the red blood cells being destroyed outside. And if you're destroying red blood cells, what do you break the hemoglobin down to? Is to bilirubin, and now you become jaundiced. And what because you have so much bilirubin, it gets supersaturated solution in your bile that's stored in your gallbladder that it precipitates out as gallstones or pigmented or bilirubinate type stones. The biggest problem with sickle cell is capillary thrombi. Because when we have those occluded blood vessels, what happens to the blood flow? Decreases, right? So what now is going to be increased is fibrinoplatelet thrombi. That's going to further cause occlusion and cause problem with oxygenation. So you get a vaso-occlusive crisis. And what happens to the poor spleen over many years that the patient who has sickle cell, if they're sickling and causing obstruction to the spleen, you get infarction over the years, and now the spleen becomes non-functional. We call this autosplenectomy. Because the spleen takes care of circulating microorganisms that are traveling, that are encapsulated, bacteria to be precise, in the blood, that when you have a spleen that's missing, they have problems of infections. And one of the infections that can occur is Salmonella osteomyelitis. Salmonella is normally found in the gut flora. Remember, how many cell layers do your gut? It's only one single layer. So now if you have sickling in your gut, in the blood, the capillaries underneath the epithelium, and they can break down, Salmonella can get into the bloodstream, now circulate and go to your bone and produce osteomyelitis. Yes. Why the spleen? Because that's a very good question. Remember, the spleen is the normal organ that takes care of old red blood cells. So the blood is going through the splenic artery, which is coming off the celiac trunk, which is a branch off the aorta. Because the spleen is a lot of sinusoids, that as the red blood cell gets in there, and it doesn't, it's because it has so much sinusoids, it ends up there's less oxygen there as a function of time, and now it can sickle and cause infarction. Versus other organs, the blood flow is going to be much greater, and you have the less likelihood of that happening. Because the spleen is made of anatomically, if you do look at the gross anatomy of the spleen, it's called the red pulp and the white pulp. The predominant component is the red pulp, is where the red blood cell is circulating through it in these sinusoids that are lined by macrophages. So because of the low flow that's going in there, relative to other organ systems, like the kidney and others, it's going to be more likely to sickle and infarct. Okay? That answer? Okay? Then another thing is it leads to leg ulcers, because what happens to the oxygenation in your lower extremities compared to other parts of the body? It's less. So you get a hypoxia, sickling, and you're going to have breakdown of the skin, and you get these non-healing ulcers. And if they're diabetic and have sickle cell, they're not in good shape. Anybody know what the term priapism? Has anybody heard the priapism, what that means? Priapism is a condition only occurs in males. It's a painful, sustained erection. Because when a man gets an erection, for example, is because it's the erectile tissues, is blood being pumped into it. That means blood has to be released to leave it to deflate the erectile tissue. Now, if you have a sickle cell patient, and now the cells start to sickle in the venous side and prevents blood from leaving, it's like pumping blood into it. What, like pumping air into a tire? It just gets bigger and bigger, and it stretches and stretches, and it is very painful. And what can happen is, what's going to happen to the oxygen content in that erectile tissue of the penis? Leading to hypoxia. And these have to be basically incised to relieve the pressure as a consequence of this condition. So it's an unwanted, sustained, painful contraction. And then another one is acute chest pain because you're sickling in the capillaries within the heart or the myocardium, leading to ischemia. Acute ischemia. This is what a spleen looks like after many years of autosplenectomy. It doesn't look like a normal spleen. If you have a ruler, look how big that spleen is. Normally, it should be about 10 to 14 or 15 centimeters in length and a lot thicker. And so you can see this is what happens to the spleen, and you can, as a consequence of multiple infarction and scarring and fibrosis. What does all scar tissue do? Contract, and that's why you get these small shriveled up spleens. This is what one looks like. What's left is the red area, is the red pulp, and you can see it's not very functional. Another condition that can lead to hemolysis is glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase deficiency, and this is a problem of, it's a X-link, so it's males, where it can't go through the process and generate glutathione, and glutathione is an important reductant for free radicals. And what happens in the red blood cell, it causes the oxidation of the hemoglobin molecule to become what is called a Heinz body. And this is what a Heinz body looks like. You get these clumping of oxidized hemoglobin under the surface of the plasma membrane. And then because it changes the fluidity of the plasma membrane, when it goes to the spleen, the macrophage takes a bite out of it. See, it looks like something. You ever seen anybody in your household or roommates take a bite out of an apple and leave it behind? That's what it reminds me of. It tells me a macrophage is taking a bite out of that red blood cell. So it's a reflection of oxidized hemoglobin. Drugs that precipitate is quinine, for example. If they have glucose-6-phosphate dehydrogenase, it causes oxidation of hemoglobin, and it can lead to more Heinz bodies and hemolysis because of this process. This is hereditary spherocytosis, and here we see in the left panel, you see this diagram. You see the plasma membrane of red blood cell has what we call band 3 proteins. They have ankyrin and spectrin. These are anchoring proteins for the cytoskeleton of the red blood cell, and these are defective. The most common cause of hereditary spherocytosis is ankyrin. You see that in that purple. And basically, now it leads to instability of the plasma membrane of red blood cell. You can see down below, as a function of time, parts of the red blood cell surface area come off as pieces, And what's going to happen to the surface? The volume ratio becomes a sphere instead of a donut. And who do you see going to take out that sphere are the macrophage and the spleen. So one of the treatments for this disease is to remove the spleen, because you get rid of the macrophages taking up the spherocytes. And so it's a membrane skeletal, cytoskeletal defect, making it plasma membrane unstable. You have decreased surface to volume ratio as pieces come off, and then it becomes less deformable as a function of loss of surface area, and now it gets trapping in the spleen and the macrophage takes it out as a function of time. This is what it looks like. Here you see a pallor of red blood cell right here, and here in the center, you can see it looks like a sphere. So this is called hereditary spherocytosis. Another cause of spherocytes is a disease we talked about in immunopathology, is antibodies directed to red blood cells, autoimmune hemolytic anemia. And you can see there are a lot of spherocytes. You see no pallor, and it's because the antibody binding to the red blood cell and an antigen on its surface, it activates complement, and you get lysis of the red blood cell, a piece of it come off the plasma membrane and now produce spheres, just like hereditary spherocytosis. A test that's given to distinguish a immunologic versus non-immunologic reaction that leads to spherocytes is what is called the Coombs test, and measures the presence or absence of antibodies to the red blood cell. And so by doing that, if it's Coombs positive, it means it's autoimmune hemolytic anemia because it's antibody mediated damage to the red blood cell. If it's Coombs negative, it's a disease like hereditary spherocytosis where it's an anchoring protein that's defective. So the last thing, a normal sick anemia outside or inside the bone marrow is decreased red blood cell production. You think of a disease called aplastic anemia. Now, what does plasia mean? Like hyperplasia, metaplasia, dysplasia, neoplasia, what does plasia mean? Growth. So what does A mean? Without growth. So it's telling you, you're not only you can't grow or you can't cause proliferation of red blood cells, but also the white blood cells. So aplastic anemia means that all the bone marrow precursors are not being made, including red blood cells. And why they call it predominantly anemia, because it leads to what form of cell injury? Hypoxia. And that's important. It can also increase the risk for infections because you're wiping out your white blood cells. Then what are diseases that we've talked about that like to destroy the bone? Is metastatic cancers. That could lead to anemia. Or if you have scarring of the bone marrow, myelofibrosis, or you have genetic diseases where macrophages accumulate, we call this Gaucher's disease because they can't break down complex molecules. Or decreased erythropoietin production. What organ makes erythropoietin? No. Kidneys. So what's the most chronic disease that destroys your kidneys you're going to see clinically in patients? Is diabetes mellitus. And so this could lead to decreased erythropoietin, you get a normocytic anemia because they can't make enough erythropoietin to cause the bone marrow to cause proliferation to make red blood cells. Okay. Rheumatoid arthritis is another. It can be associated with a normocytic anemia. So aplastic anemia, you have some type of genetic defect that's in the stem cells, and some type of antigen prevents them from furthering, or the immune system looks at it and destroys the marrow elements, and you can't make red blood cells or white blood cells. So now the last thing before we leave the anemias and go on to hemopoietic malignancies is a macrocytic anemia. Macro meaning what? Big cells, but it's less of them. And so in this case, it's a problem of maturation of red blood cells, and it's a problem of DNA synthesis in the stem cells, leading to erythroid production, as well as the white blood cells, or the myeloid or lymphoid stem cells. So it involves the metabolic pathway of DNA synthesis involving tetrahydrofolate, reductase pathway, and you get this long maturation in the bone marrow, but less red blood cells, so the red blood cells look bigger, but you have less of them. So this is called a macrocytic. The most common ones you're going to see is vitamin B12 deficiency and folic acid deficiency. This is just to remind me, to remind you, vitamin B12, since you've gone through Thanksgiving, you ate. Did everyone eat well? Good. You had plenty of vitamin B12, because vitamin B12 is found in what? Muscle of various animals, including human beings. And when you were eating your Thanksgiving meal, you were taking an intake of vitamin B12. That vitamin B12 is basically, with the saliva from your mouth, is going to coat it with a protein, R-binding proteins, or R-binders, that's going to protect it from the acid in the stomach. Once it's being digested, to prevent it from being destroyed by having it coated with protein, you're basically, in order to get it taken up by your small intestine and your terminal ileum, you make a protein from the parietal cells called intrinsic factor. But it can't bind to that protein that's coating the vitamin B12 until the pancreas releases chymotrypsin and trypsin that breaks it down, the binding proteins, exposing the vitamin B12 to intrinsic factor, which now can bind to it. And here you can see being absorbed in the terminal ileum. What inflammatory bowel disease we talked about last week can destroy the terminal ileum, leading to vitamin B12 deficiency? Not ulcerative colitis, because that involves just the colon. What inflammatory bowel disease destroys any part of the GI tract, including the small intestine or terminal ileum, would be Crohn's disease. That's right. So this is why it's important to know how vitamin B12 is being brought into the body, its source. It's stored in skeletal muscle. So if it's stored in skeletal muscle and it's also stored in the liver, how many years would it take to get vitamin B12 deficiency? Be 10, 20, depending upon your skeletal mass and your liver mass. If you're a small person versus a large person, who is more likely to go through vitamin B12 deficiency sooner? Smaller individuals or thin people have less muscle mass or body stature? So this is not to be memorized, but cobalamin is another name for vitamin B12. It's important with methionine synthetase, with methionine or homocysteine methionine, and it's important for the tetrahydrofolate acid, that's FH4, and thymidylate synthetase, leading to DNA synthesis. So what are the causes of vitamin B12 deficiency? What age group do you think are people that have to worry about it? It's not found in plants. So if you're a strict vegetarian, you need vitamin supplementation, because you can lead to vitamin B12 deficiency because it's found in skeletal muscle, obviously animals, and liver. So having a poor diet, what age group do you think would have a problem with vitamin B12 deficiency? The elderly, just like iron. What happens to your diet when you get older? You eat less, and depending upon your access to good foods or variety of foods, it can lead to deficiencies, not only metals, but vitamins. Impaired absorption. There's a anemia that's called pernicious anemia, where you have antibodies to the parietal cells that will not make the ability to make acid, but also not intrinsic factor, and you can't bind the vitamin B12 and lead to deficiency. And this is a very common cause of deficiency in the Western Hemisphere. Another disease we just talked about is Crohn's disease, because it can destroy the terminal ileum and interfere with its absorption. And there's other enzyme deficiencies and drugs that can be associated with this. So what are the signs and symptoms? Chronic disease takes 20 to 30 years, typically. So what groups of people, what sort of beverages are vitamin deficient? Alcoholic beverages. Remember, always look at alcoholic beverages and nutritional value and see what you find in it. There's not a whole lot. Okay. And so they're not vitamin enriched, okay? And so you have to worry about the intake. So you get weakness and dyspnea because it's going to affect the skeletal muscle metabolism, including the primary muscle of respiration, the diaphragm. It'll affect the cardiac muscle. It can lead to congestive heart failure, affect contractility. It can also lead to a beefy red tongue. And why is it beefy red? Because it affects the DNA synthesis of all cells, including labile cells, like your epithelium on your tongue, the squamous or the buccal mucosa. So it becomes thinner and thinner because you have less ability to make squamous cells. And because you're using it to articulate or talk, as well as to eat, it'll become inflamed and beefy red. Sheilosis is basically when we don't think about it, but when we use our lips for breathing or talking and opening our mouth for whatever the occasion may be, is that we're causing mechanical forces on the at the corners of our mouth. And these, where if they become thin, they can crack and become very painful. And it's again because you can't make enough squamous cells that provide a structural support at that area. The other important thing you have to remember, it affects the central nervous system, and it affects it by a variety of ways. It affects the oligodendrocytes, leading to demyelination like the posterior spinal tract, which is important for vibration and position. They can lead to loss of position of your joints and leading to degenerative joint disease. It can affect the sensory and lead to tingling or burning hands and feet. The spinal cerebral tracts, leading to problems of coordination, dystaxia, the legs and arms, and also affects the motor involving the cortical spinal tract, leading to paralysis or spastic paralysis. This is what a macrocytic anemia looks like. Here you see the red blood cells are quite big and there's less hemoglobin in them. And basically these are Howell jaw bodies right here in the center. It also affects the maturation of the white blood cells. And because it takes longer for white blood cells to mature, they get hypersegmentation. You see there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The normal segmentation in a neutrophil is 3 to 5. Would I ask that on the exam next week? No. Just this is how we look at it. It affects all cells that are dividing. And what's the predominant cell in the body in folate and vitamin B12 deficiency would be essentially the labile cells like your bone marrow cells. That's why it leads to anemia as well as affecting white blood cells. The last is folic acid. Folic acid is found primarily in vegetables. It's a water-soluble vitamin. And it's basically, we can't store it. So that's why, which deficiency will lead to macrocytic anemia quicker or sooner in a patient? Folic acid deficiency or vitamin B12 deficiency? Folic acid, because we can't store it. So it occurs within months versus vitamin B12. We store it in our muscle and liver, so it takes years. Because we can store it for vitamin B12, but we can't store folic acid. And so folic acid is important in DNA synthesis in the tetrahydrofolate reductase pathway for DNA, just like vitamin B12. So what are the causes? Again, dietary deficiency. What age group is most vulnerable to this is going to be the pediatric as well as the elderly. Again, restricted diet. Chronic alcoholics, they have a restricted diet, tea and toast, because they can't afford anything else. Decreased absorption, and this is a water-soluble vitamin, and water-soluble vitamins compared to a vitamin B12 is it gets absorbed in the small intestine in the more proximal portion, the duodenum and jejunum. So you have problems that destroy that, like celiac sprue, which is an immunologic damage to the small intestine. Or you have increased, what groups of people have increased risk or increased need for folic acid are pregnancy. One of the important things that's important for DNA synthesis is the nervous system in the fetus can lead to neural tube defects. Because women have been taking folic acid as part of their perinatal care, that you've reduced neural tube defects over 50%. So all women who are pregnant must take folic acid. That becomes very important because the requirement for DNA synthesis is much higher. So infancy, hyperthyroidism, because it increases the mean metabolic rate of cells, including labile cells, and it's important to have enough folic acid, as well as cancer. Why would cancer, maybe malignant tumors, lead to folic acid deficiency? Because what are malignant cancer cells doing? They're what? They're dividing. That means DNA synthesis. So what cofactor would they need more of? Vitamin B12 and folic acid. But they're going to You'd have plenty of folic acid, I mean vitamin B12 in your muscle, but you don't have, it can't store it, so malignancy would consume it because it's dividing cells. Okay, very good. And there are drugs that can be antagonists, and one that you don't see on the slide, but you can see it, is methotrexate, a common drug that inhibits DNA synthesis through folic acid metabolism. And so antagonists like methotrexate, people are on it for a variety of conditions, can lead to folic acid deficiency. So folic acid signs symptoms, it doesn't affect the CNS compared to vitamin B12 deficiency, so it's all going to be a reflection of hypoxia as a consequence of megaloblastic anemia, okay? And so that's anemia in a short period of time, an overview that's showing there's microcytic, normocytic, and macrocytic anemia, and it leads to what form of cell injury? Hypoxia. Okay, very good. Any questions about anemias? Let's go to the white blood cell disorder. So the first one we're going to talk about today and continue this conversation tomorrow is hemopoietic malignancies of the white blood cells. Okay, again, very great question. What is happening in the fetus is the neuronal cells are dividing. So that's, it becomes important for that brain and the spinal cord and the nerves, they're dividing. So therefore they need a lot of DNA synthesis and a lot of cofactors, including folic acid and vitamin B12. You're not going to see vitamin B12 deficiency during pregnancy because the mother stores it where? Where does she store it? In her skeletal muscle, including cardiac, and her liver. So there's no way you can get vitamin B12 deficiency, but she can't store folate. Okay? So she's got to get it from her diet. That's why you need to supplement the diet to make sure it has plenty of folic acid so the fetus is not going to have problems of neural tube defects. But now when you're an adult, what happens to your proliferation of neuronal tissue? Decreases, right? So you don't have a lot of DNA synthesis, but you have to maintain mitochondria and all that to have DNA. And so the vitamin deficiency is going to be more dependent upon now vitamin B12 deficiency versus folic acid. Okay? See the difference between the two. Very good. Any other questions? Seeing none, let's move on to tumors. Lymphomas. Now, don't worry about the Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's for a moment. Lymphomas is referring to malignancy of lymphocytes. Okay? We're going to go through the normal histology of a lymph node. We'll come to the clinical distinction, what's called lymphadenopathy, big, enlarged lymph nodes, and what we have to think about. Because you're going to do a physical exam on patients, you may come across lymph nodes that are enlarged. You're trying to think of what could cause these lymph nodes to be enlarged. Then how do you evaluate a patient that has lymphadenopathy? And then if one of the reasons that can cause a lymph node to become enlarged is lymphoma or malignancy of the lymphocytes arising in that lymphoid tissue. The nomenclature, we'll talk about that, and there are subtypes called Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's, and there's several subtypes under each one of these, but they're both called lymphomas, talk about therapy, and then prognosis. So let's go through the normal histology of a lymph node. A lymph node has both T and B cells. We've talked about in the cortex or the outside of the lymph node is B cells. The B cells become what cells after being presented with antigen by the antigen-presenting cells, macrophages, is going to become plasma cells. They make the antibodies that will bind to various molecules, especially those of microbial organisms, viruses, bacteria, fungi, and so forth. And they're destroyed or removed by the immune system. That's in the cortex. Lymph nodes have a capsule around them, a thin connective tissue capsule. And it's this cortex that's touching that capsule is where you have the germinal centers. We'll explain why in a moment. Then around these islands or germinal centers or follicles are T cells, the pericortical areas. And these are predominantly T cells, whether helper cells, the cytotoxic T8 cells. And then the medulla, which is the inner core of the inside, the outside of the cortex, is going to be made where you have plasma cells making what? Antibodies that are secreted and released. And then it has to flow out of the lymph node. So there's got to be flow coming into a lymph node and flow leaving out the lymph node in the medulla. We call these the lymphatic vessels. So those that occur, that come to the capsule on the outside where the cortex is the afferent channels. Those that leave the lymph node are called the efferent channels. So let's think of something. Let's say a microorganism in the skin somewhere, and it goes in the lymph node or lymphatics. It travels to the lymph node in the capsule, gets into the sinusoid. Now an antigen-presenting cell sees it, presents it to a B cell through a T helper cell. It now goes through the maturation of genetic recombination to go through the process of becoming a plasma cell to make a unique antibody for that particular microorganism. Once the plasma cell is making this antibody, it's going to leave the efferent and then travel in lymph. Lymph will get into the venous side. The venous will go through the lungs and then travel through the rest of the body. And this is how we make the antibodies that travel and are going to look for antigens to bind to in order to set off an immunologic response or get it removed. So when you talk about a lymph node, lymphadenopathy means there's enlargement lymph node. The way you think of this clinically, is it reactive or is it malignant? That's the first thing. There are two reasons why that lymph node is increased in size. Is it reactive or non-neoplastic versus neoplastic? So the first thing, when we talk about reactive, what do you think is a common cause that leads your lymph nodes to become bigger? Due to what cause? Infections. How many people have had pharyngitis? Sore throats. If you palpate your lymph nodes, strep throat, you may feel the drainage of the cervical lymph nodes are enlarged because they've been exposed to those antigens that cause the inflammatory process, and you have enlarged glands. That's what people call it, euphemistically, but they're lymph nodes. And it's because you're making hyperplasia. You have hyperplasia of the germinal centers in response to the antigen from the microorganism. And cat scratches another microorganism, as the name implies, from the being scratched by a cat, that a microorganism that get into your skin and travels to the lymphatics and causes lymphadenopathy. Another cause is autoimmune diseases. Because you have self-antigens, you've got to make antibodies to it, like rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or other conditions that we've talked about, like systemic lupus erythematosus can have lymphadenopathy. Another cause is drug reactions. Or you have reactions to that can lead to hypersensitivity reaction, making antibodies like IgE. You get lymphadenopathy. Dilantin is well known to increase lymphoid cells as a consequence, hyperplasia. Or irritants. What if people are not satisfied with their body parts? So what do they inject into themselves? Silicone. Not a good idea. Silicone is a chemical irritant. And the macrophages don't like it. And they go crazy over it. And it goes to lymph nodes and causes lymphadenopathy. So this is all reactive. Now, when you have an infection, for example, and you've created this hyperplasia, the lymph nodes may stay enlarged for the rest of the person's life. But they don't get bigger. Because if it was neoplasia, what would happen to the lymph node? Get bigger, right? Makes sense. So even after if you had chronic infections in your throat, for example, people often after this lecture come up to me and say, do I have lymphoma? I said, no, because the question I ask, have you had infections in the past? And they say, yes. And I say, well, has it changed? No, this is all reactive. So they can stay permanently enlarged, and it's a reflection of the antigenic presentation. Or unknown etiology, you have granulomas due to sarcoidosis. This is what reactive lymphadenopathy looks like. Here you see the lymph node, here's the capsule. And when you have reactive lymph nodes, like during an infection, and they go through this hyperplasia, it stretches the lymph node capsule, it has sensory nerves in it. And that's why when the doctor or whoever's examining, nurse practitioner, physical therapist, whoever, a dentist doing a head and neck exam, and you palpate a gland and it feels tender on palpation, or the patient complains of tenderness or pain, it's a reflection of an acute process, that rapid expansion and stretching the lymph node capsule. And this is what it looks like. You can see these lymph nodes are fairly enlarged, they're 2 or 3 centimeters. Anybody in this room would be able to feel the difference. When you look at it microscopically, if we look onto the outside, this pink structure is the capsule. And here you see these islands or germinal centers on the cortex. Here's the medulla. The afferent are coming in the left right corner is where the antigen would be presented, or microorganism. You get the lymphadenopathy. The plasma cells are going to be releasing antibody and go through the afferent up to the upper left-hand corner. And so that's the process. And here you see the germinal centers. There's two of them here. And the uncommitted B cells are on the outside, called the mantle zone, that gets transformed genetically through recombination to make the various chains of immunoglobulin to make up the antibody that will bind to a specific epitope that's presented by the microorganism or any other causes of reactive. And here you just see a closer view of the heterogeneity and morphologic changes that's taking place within the germinal center as it's going through this hypersomatic mutation recombination. So when it's malignant, what do you think is the most common tumor to be found in your lymph nodes? Metastatic cancers or lymphomas, if you had to take a guess? Metastatic cancers, okay, is by far the most common thing. So you may have patients. If you have patients that are diagnosed, you're called for PT, and you do an exam on them, you'll find if they have malignant cancer, you'll find lymphadenopathy. If you have breast cancer, where does it go to? Common source of the axillary lymph nodes or the cervical lymph nodes. You think of GI cancers, ovarian cancer, remember Virchow's lymph node. So there are various lymph nodes that one can palpate as a reflection of cancer. So the most common is going to be secondary or metastatic. When it arises in the lymph node, we call it lymphoma. That's a very important distinction. Whether you call it Hodgkin's or non-Hodgkin lymphoma, it's telling you it's arising in lymphoid tissues. Where other lymphoid tissues do we have in our body besides lymph nodes? One is the white pulp of the spleen, so you can get enlarged spleens. It could be along the GI tract, including the oral cavity. You think of the tonsils are lymphoid tissue. They can give rise to lymphomas. Or the lymphoid tissue along the GI tract, lymphoid tissue in your lungs, higher lymph nodes. You can get even primary brain lymphomas when we talk about AIDS, because you have lymphoid, you don't have lymphatics or lymph nodes in the brain, but you have aggregates of lymphoid cells that could go through transformation. So where you have lymphocytes, they can give rise to lymphoma. If they arise in the bone marrow, when you have hemopoietic white blood cells, then we think of, these are called leukemias. So this is the most important definition. A difference between lymphoma and leukemia is the site of origin. If it arises from lymphoid cells in lymphoid tissue, we call it lymphoma. When it arises in the bone marrow, we call it leukemia, because they're going to be the ability to circulate and throughout the body. So secondary metastatic, or another name. Okay? This is what lymphoma looks like. What food does it remind me of? Scallops. When I see of scallops, kind of fleshy, bulging white, and the lymph node, and when you have metastatic cancer or lymphomas in a lymph node, what happens is it tends to be painless lymphadenopathy. Why do you think it's painless compared to a reactive lymphadenopathy? Why would a metastatic cancer or a lymphoma give you painless lymphadenopathy, while if you had a reactive process, like in an infection, you get a painful lymphadenopathy? It can expand, but what do cancer cells like to do? If I'm a cancer cell, what do I like to do? I divide, but also I do what to tissues? I spread. What do we call that when we call that when we're spreading inside a tissue? The I word. Invasion. So what it goes through, I'll get it out of you eventually. It's called the installment plan. If you have a malignant tumor, what is it going to invade through tissue? Couldn't it invade right through the capsule? And you wouldn't feel anything. It's single cells. It shows no respect. Versus when you have a reactive process, hyperplasia, it's going to show respect. It's going to be confined and cause it to stretch. Versus when it infiltrates, it's enlarging it, but it's infiltrating, and so it's not going to lead to a painful lymph node or lymphoid tissue. So, how do you evaluate a patient with lymphadenopathy? You want to palpate it for tenderness. If there's tenderness, you can more likely be reactive. Bogginess means, and it's painful, it's suppurative. In other words, there's a lot of necrosis or inflammation. It's very tender. Matting is a term that's used clinically where you have a lot of scarring. If you have chronic injury to the lymph node or lymph node chain, then you can get scarring and basically cause the contraction and lymph nodes to come closer together. Commonplace is your inguinal lymph nodes. In your inguinal area down here, because of chronic injuries that you've had or dermatitis or athlete's foot or whatever else, this chronic injury can stimulate the antigens and lead to scarring or burnout. One of the things when you have lymphadenopathy is because the lymph node has macrophages, and it can release what, whether it's neoplastic or non-neoplastic, reactive or neoplastic, can release IL-1 and tumor necrosis factor, leading to fever. So fever can be both in reactive lymphadenopathy and lymphadenopathy due to cancer because you're activating macrophages. But how do you make the diagnosis of any type of process that you're concerned about to make sure it's reactive or a malignancy is look for a biopsy or final aspiration and to see whether it's reactive or neoplastic. And so a good clinical history and correlation becomes very important in assessing a patient. So this is the most important slide of this lecture and tomorrow's lecture is, as I mentioned earlier, you should know the difference between leukemias and lymphomas, and this will be asked on the exam. Okay, we'll go over it again in the review on Thursday. Leukemias arise where? In the bone marrow, whether it's from the lymphoid or the myeloid series. We'll talk about more about leukemias tomorrow. Because they fill up the bone marrow, think of it like a bucket, it has volume to it, it fills it up, it spills out, and now travels through the rest of the body and increases the white cell count and now circulates through the capillary system and causes injury because there's less red blood cells in the bone marrow because you now lead to a normocytic anemia because you replaced it with hematopoietic malignant cells, and now it's going to cause further injury and destruction to the tissues. Versus lymphomas, they arise within lymphoid tissue. As we point out, tonsils, lymph nodes, lymphoid tissue throughout the body, the white pulp, Peyer's patches, or the terminal ileum as a consequence. There are two types of lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's, we're going to talk about and continue this conversation tomorrow morning with the Hodgkin's lymphoma that represents about 3/4 of the types of lymphomas versus Hodgkin's. Now, why are we making this distinction? It's prognosis. And when you have Hodgkin's lymphoma, it's curable. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has been advanced and improved in terms of the quality, but Hodgkin's lymphoma has a better prognosis than non-Hodgkin's, and it's based on the morphologic presence or absence of what is called the Reed-Sternberg cell, which is a malignant B cell that has a bilobed nucleus, which we'll look at tomorrow. So we'll start with non-Hodgkin lymphomas and then continue this tomorrow and go on to Hodgkin's and leukemias. So now, this is not to be memorized. There's an important concept on this slide. You can see bone marrow, and you can see the thymus. The B cells come from the bone marrow, and the T cells come from the thymus. When you ask the question, what type of malignancies come from either primarily B or T cells, looking at this simple diagram, where do you see most of the malignancies coming from, B cells or T cells? Which side? Which side?
B
B, why would that occur? Because if you think of what a B cell's doing, they become eventually what? Plasma cells. In order to become a plasma cell, genetically, what do you have to do is a lot of gene rearrangements. So if you have a cell that goes through a lot of gene rearrangements, what happens to mutation rates? Goes up. So therefore, that's why the majority of leukemias that are lymphocytes that travel, circulate, or that arise in the lymph nodes, we call these lymphomas, are primarily what? B cells. How many do you see for T cells? Just one or two. Because you have T cell rearrangements that are a lot less to produce genetic rearrangements compared to B cells. So that's the other important message that I want to leave you today, as the majority of these leukemias and lymphomas that arise from lymphoid cells are B cells. And you know why? Because cancer is a genetic disease, and therefore if you have the propensity to have mutations occurring to begin with, it increases the likelihood of becoming a neoplastic process. Okay? So non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is a spectrum of many different diseases. So I'm just pulling a few examples. And there are textbooks on lymphomas, pretty thick. So this is just giving you an overview. So there's roughly 48 to 50,000 cases per year in the United States. Mean age usually is middle age, 42, increasing incidence, and a lot of the causes for it is unknown. And the presenting features, basically they're going to present with superficial lymphadenopathy. You may be the first one to discover it. If other people have not done a physical exam, a thorough physical exam, you may palpate the lymphadenopathy, painless, rubbery, and discreet as a reflection. And about 20% of these patients will be symptomatic. In other words, they have release of the macrophages, IL-1 and tumor necrosis factor, leading to fever, night sweats. For example, weight loss, or even itching because of release of mast cells, because of reflection of IL-1 and tumor necrosis factor. And remember, why the weight loss? Because TNF, or tumor necrosis factor, suppresses your appetite. That's why we talked about this in inflammation. When you have a lot of TNF, you don't feel like eating when you're sick. It's because of this reflection. Nomenclature is all different types of nomenclatures. People are trying to give different names, system names to these to help provide the best care, therapies that will be most effective and a good prognosis. Okay? So we're going to talk about nodular or follicular. When I say follicular, what part of the lymph node does that represent? What lymphocytes? I say follicular. T or B cells? Is it P or T or B cells when I say follicular? B. So what do you think is the most common non-Hodgkin lymphoma? Is called follicular lymphoma. It's trying to look like, or nodular lymphoma is another name, it's given in the past, you may have come across, versus when it loses its ability to differentiate into germinal centers, we call this diffuse lymphomas. And it's the germinal centers or follicular centers. And when we use the term, when we destroy the architecture of the lymph node, we call this effacement of the nodal architecture. So these germinal centers or follicular lymphomas are basically, they don't have the normal structural appearance, but they're all over the lymph node within the medulla and the cortex and replacing the normal structure. And they're going to have homogeneous cells in both nodular and follicular, depending upon whether they're well differentiated as follicular lymphomas or poorly differentiated as diffuse lymphomas. And diffuse lymphomas, because they're less differentiated, tend to be clinically more aggressive. And so we'll end at this point and continue on, finish up lymphomas, non-Hodgkin's, Hodgkin's, and leukemias mañana. Any questions? This podcast was recorded by Dr. Henry Sanchez at the University of California, San Francisco.